but it's good pay. So an enormous number of Fijian men who have had prior military experience are now in the Middle East doing security guard work. The younger ones, though, that haven't joined up to the Fijian military are now being recruited by our military and by the British military to come fight our war. So this should not be happening. So wherever you have friends in other parts of the world, write them about it. Ask them to go to their U.S. embassy and ask to talk to the defense attaché and ask that man or woman what's going on, how many people they've recruited, and is that really right? Thanks for that question. Yes, ma'am.
Do you know George Galloway?
The question is, have I ever spoken with George Galloway, the UK parliamentarian who came over to the US Congress and gave an earful? No, I've not met that man, but I certainly hope to. And in fact, I'll be going to London the first week of August is the Veterans for Peace convention in Dallas. And how many of you all are members of Veterans for Peace? Great. How many of you all should be? And I should say everybody ought to raise their hand. Because this is an excellent organization that has been in existence for about 40 years that really, really, they're veterans or friends of veterans. The conference we'll be having in Dallas is going to be really motivating, exciting. Veterans for Peace is the organization where five of its chapters, and they've got about 50 chapters all over the country, five of them in California have what's called Arlington West. Arlington West happens every Sunday afternoon, where now 1,760 crosses for the numbers of Americans who have been killed. That number of crosses are placed precisely on beaches, five beaches in California. I mean, and it looks like Arlington Cemetery, the way that it is laid out. There's a website called Arlington West. That group tries so hard to bring to the attention of the American public what really is happening. Well, anyway, I'm going to be speaking at the Veterans for Peace conference, and then from there I get on a plane and go to London, because we are going to be talking with UK parliamentarians, with Congressman John Conyers. We're going to continue the Downing Street memos. And what we want to be doing is talking to the UK parliamentarians to let them know what the American public is thinking of these memos. We want to push them to heighten the push on their own government. When they heighten that push, then we'll use the publicity that they get for that to come back and have another salvo here in America. So it's really important. There are a lot of good UK parliamentarians that we'll be meeting with, and I'll give you a report next time I'm in Houston. The question is, how can we accept these lies? And as you are indicating, we cannot. We have to stand up to this. We needed to stand up in 2 million, 3 million more numbers on November 2nd. We almost came close to getting him out of office, and some people say we did. The point, though, is that the same numbers of people are very concerned. In fact, more of them are. If you know in your own families and your own friends, so many people who may admit that they voted for Bush are now really, really disenchanted. So we've got to capitalize on all these new people that are coming in that are so distraught about what's going on. And there are a couple of avenues. I mean, there are a couple of groups that are calling for impeachment. You can work with them. There are other groups that are saying, don't go for that. Go for serious crimes. Go with that. So, and every day, every single day, take some time to do something and be out on the streets and be in front of your congressman or woman's office. Thanks.
One more hand for Ann.
We've been listening to a speech by former diplomat Colonel Ann Wright speaking on July 23rd in Houston, Texas. Thanks to Wally James, Pokey Anderson, and Byron Jackson for making that tape available to us. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. Last week on the program, we played a portion of a day-long Capitol Hill briefing The 9/11 Commission Report, 1 year later, a citizen's critique, did the commission get it right? Sponsored by Democratic Congressmember Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. Next, we've got more material from that day-long briefing. The first speaker will be Dr. Ann Norton, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, who is the author of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire, a study of the ideological roots of the neocons now running the U.S. government.
I want to return to politics and to the political questions which seem to me to be at the forefront of certain aspects of American policy in the world after 9/11. Some of these are the rising executive power, the expanding tolerance of authoritarianism both at home and abroad, and the changing focus of American foreign and domestic policy. Central to this is the change in American conservatism. American conservatism once had a certain sort of fairly recognizable profile, a commitment to certain tenets. Conservatives reverenced custom and tradition. They distrusted abstract projects, grand theories. They advocated balanced budgets and small government, and they were frugal about government spending. They were cautious, above all. This disposition and the political positions that expressed it have a very long history in the United States, but it has been radically altered in recent years. Neoconservatives are not conservative according to this traditional model, and they are, as they will tell you, as Tom DeLay once told me, they are revolutionaries. Neoconservatives have a rather different and rather disturbing profile. They want a strong state. A state that will put its strength to use, that allies itself and will empower corporations. They have an economic rhetoric that speaks to the concerns of small business, small property owners, and working people, but the benefits are given to wealthy individuals and corporations. They reject the vulgarity of mass culture. They deplore the decadence of artists and intellectuals. Although often not religious themselves, they ally themselves with religion and religious crusades. They encourage family values. For women, a return to children, cooking, and the church. They make a romance of war, arguing that war will restore manliness, private virtue, and public spirit. They favor the expansion of executive power. They admire authoritarian leaders abroad, especially, as you have already heard, Pakistan's Pervez Musharraf. And they argue that America itself would profit from a more authoritarian presidency and what they call a more disciplined democracy. A more disciplined democracy, as they define it, is one with more surveillance of the people, more secrecy in the government, and willingness to employ methods earlier conservatives and indeed earlier Americans rejected, the curtailment of civil rights and, of course, torture. Treating the 9/11 as an institutional problem has given them a license to expand executive power and to employ these previously prescribed methods. Neoconservative foreign policy centers on a fear of world government and the international institutions that might lead to it, most notably the United Nations, a rejection of multilateralism, and, as they say, above all, the ability to distinguish friends from enemies. Neoconservatives are wont to describe this particular ability to distinguish friends from enemies to Thucydides, but it belongs to Carl Schmitt, often called the crown jurist of the Third Reich. Schmitt regarded the distinction between friend and enemy as the foundation of politics. And along with this, he argued that sovereignty came not from the people, but from the decision, that is to say, the capacity of the executive, the ruler, to decide matters, and that arbitrary power was foundational for sovereignty. These ideas came to neoconservatism both directly from Carl Schmitt and through Leo Strauss, who has taught many of the most prominent neoconservatives in the present administration and indeed in neoconservative think tanks throughout the city and indeed throughout the country. Neoconservatives have employed this ideology as a rationale for the expansion of executive power. Europeans regard neoconservative with special skepticism, and they do so, as you might have already realized, because they know its progenitors all too well. You know, the desire for the combination of traditional values, the desire for an expansion of executive power, the ambition to create a new world order, and the identification of a providential enemy are all parts of a very familiar past. The shadows of German National Socialism and 19th century European empires fall very heavily on the neoconservative project. As the administration responded to 9/11, this influence became increasingly evident. Before 9/11, neoconservatives saw America's military hegemony as an opportunity. As they argued, national security should no longer be concerned with defending against threats, rather it should be regarded as an opportunity, and that opportunity should be seized. In their words, America should seek to make trouble in the world. They call this robust internationalism, an avowedly expansionist foreign policy that aimed at establishing a new world order to rival Rome and to surpass the European colonial projects of the 19th century. This vision of America's role requires considerably more. More power in the executive branch, particularly stronger police powers, more military funding, more arms, more money, a larger executive bureaucracy. After 9/11, this was America's military hegemony, its sort of unipolar character, was cast not merely as an opportunity, but as a civilizational struggle. In his first term, George Bush incautiously but accurately referred to the global war on terror as a crusade. Casting what conservatives called the Pax Americana as a civilizational struggle identified what Carl Schmitt had called the providential enemy and clarified the policy focus on the Middle East. The providential enemy is not an ordinary enemy, Schmitt argued, not one simply to be defeated. The providential enemy had to be absolutely annihilated. The promise made after 9/11 to seek the annihilation of the terrorists was a dangerous and self-defeating promise. It declared a war without a clear enemy, with no clear strategic objectives, a war without limits. This did away with the traditional constraints on the conduct of war, from the just war theories of Augustine, Aquinas, and Al-Farabi to the Geneva Convention. Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have shown us the consequences that follow when these traditional restraints are removed. Neoconservative policy in the wake of 9/11 installed a new language, a new military, and a new anti-Semitism. The new language is one in which mercenaries are called civilian contractors and foreign fighters refer solely to those not allied with the United States. The new military relied heavily on private forces, these old mercenaries now called civilian contractors, who made more for the same activity that ordinary soldiers performed for little compensation. While soldiers raid junkyards to fashion hillbilly armor, corporations are making increasing amounts of money on these privatized contracts. The old phrase in American politics, a rich man's war and a poor man's fight, acquired a new salience. The burdens of the war were borne not by the nation as a whole, but disproportionately by a few, an inequity that reflects neoconservative conceptions of the proper distinction between the few and the many, the few who rule, and the many whom the few are permitted to deceive. Moreover, it confirms Tocqueville's warnings about the dangers of a volunteer army and the importance of a draft as securing an army that in which the people as a whole bear the burdens of war. The response to 9/11 showed initially a commendable desire to avoid the immediate targeting of Muslims or Arabs. One could argue that despite the arrest of Brandon Mayfield, the detention and deportation of scores of American Muslims, the explicit rhetorical targeting of Arabs and Muslims has been largely avoided. Neoconservative foreign policy, however, has been driven by a new form of anti-Semitism. At the end of the 19th century, it was the Jewish anarchist and the Jewish communist who were portrayed as agents of global terror. Now it is Muslims who are involved in shadowy global conspiracies, Muslims who have fellow travelers. The old language of anti-Semitism has found a new target. We have licensed this anti-Semitism at home and funded it abroad on condition that it take the Arab and the Muslim rather than the Jew as its target. This has produced discrimination against Arabs and Muslims in the United States, indifference to the growth of democracy in Palestine, and a counterproductive policy of regime change in the Middle East. The targeting of Muslims as a providential enemy is evident throughout the 9/11 Commission report. I think the most glaring example is near the conclusion on page 362. Here, Islam in general is identified as the enemy because of its inability to distinguish between religion and politics, a peculiar standard and one which American politics, in even its most secular form, would not satisfy. This kind of providentialism has led to a misdirection of American military action, and it has continued political failure. The blanket condemnation of Islam hampers the ability to identify true terrorist threats, and throughout the report, it encourages a focus on institutional failure, sort of bureaucratic tidiness, rather than attention to political context. One of the most remarkable features of the 9/11 Commission report is its utter indifference to politics or to history. There's in the whole report probably a total of 3 pages on political context, an extraordinary void. One would think that this were an act of God or change in the weather and not a political act in a political context with a long, complex, but indeed widely known and widely studied history. This neoconservative policy in the wake of 9/11 and more immediately in the wake of the attacks in London and the continuing news from Iraq obliges us to conclude that neoconservative foreign policy has failed to spread democracy or to diminish terror. It has succeeded rather well, however, at diminishing democracy at home while failing to extend it abroad. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Professor Ann Norton, political scientist and author of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. Representative Cynthia McKinney introduces the next panelist.
Peter Dale Scott, Dr. Scott, is Professor Emeritus of English at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of Drugs, Oil, and War, and 7 other books, including Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, and the Iran-Contra Connection. He has also published award-winning poetry. Both his prose and poetry deal, among other matters, with U.S. covert operations, their impact on democracy at home and abroad, their relations to the John F. Kennedy assassination, and their relations to the global drug traffic. Dr. Scott holds degrees from McGill University, his city of birth. Prior to having taught for 34 years at UC Berkeley, Scott was a Canadian diplomat and served at the United Nations in the Canadian Embassy in Poland. Dr. Scott.
The American people have been seriously misled about the origins of Al-Qaeda, a movement blamed for the 9/11 attacks, just as they have been seriously misled about the reasons for America's invasion of Iraq. The truth is that for at least 2 decades, the United States has engaged in energetic programs to secure U.S. control over the Persian Gulf and also to open up Central Asia for development by U.S. oil companies. Americans were eager to gain access to the petroleum reserves of the Caspian Basin, which at that time were still estimated to be the largest known reserves of unexploited fuel in the planet. To this end, time after time, U.S. covert operations in the region have used so-called Arab-Afghan warriors as assets, the jihadis whom we loosely link with the name and leadership of Al-Qaeda. In country after country, these Arab-Afghans have been involved in trafficking Afghan heroin. America's sponsorship of drug-trafficking Muslim warriors, including those now in Al-Qaeda, dates back to the Afghan War of 1979-89, sponsored in part by the CIA's links to the drug-laundering Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI. It was part of CIA Director Casey's strategy for launching covert operations over and above those approved and financed by a democratically controlled Congress. The most conspicuous example of this alliance with drug traffickers in the 1980s was the Contra support operation. Here again, foreign money and drug profits filled the gap after Congress denied funds through the so-called Boland Amendments. In this case, government funds were also used to lie about the Contras to the American people. And I will add, apropos of this morning, that there was also a massive cover-up, including a cover-up of people, some of them convicted, who are now in the present administration. And my book, Covert Politics, talks about the role of Lee Hamilton in that cover-up. The lying continues. The 9/11 Commission report assures Americans that, quote, Bin Laden and his comrades had their own sources of support and training, and they received little or no assistance from the United States, close quote. This misleading statement fails to consider that, one, Al-Qaeda elements received considerable indirect U.S. government assistance, first in Afghanistan till 92, and thereafter in other countries such as Azerbaijan, 92 to 95, and Kosovo, 1998. Before 1992, for example, the Afghan leader Jalaluddin Haqqani organized and hosted the Arab-Afghan volunteers known later as Al-Qaeda, and in turn, Haqqani, quote, received bags of money each month from the CIA station in Islamabad, close quote. The Arab Afghans were also trained in urban terrorism, including car bombings by Pakistani ISI operatives, who in turn were trained by the CIA. Two, key members of the network, which became Al-Qaeda, such as Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, Ali Mohammed, Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, and perhaps Ayman al-Zawahiri, were granted visas to enter the United States, despite being suspected of terrorism and, in some cases, on State Department watch lists. Al-Qaeda foot soldiers were also admitted to the United States for training under a special visa program. Three, an Al-Qaeda operative at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, an Al-Qaeda operative was given a list of Muslim candidates for Al-Qaeda's jihad. Four, when Al-Qaeda personnel were trained in the United States by a key Al-Qaeda operative, Sergeant Ali Mohammed of the U.S. Army Special Forces, Mohammed was still on the U.S. Army payroll. Five, as we know, there was FBI protection of Al-Qaeda terrorists from investigation and prosecution, the case of Mousawi that we heard about this morning being just one. In part, America's limited covert assistance to Al-Qaeda after 1989 was in order not to offend Al-Qaeda's primary source supporters, which America needed as allies, the intelligence networks of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. But unquestionably, the entry of United States oil companies into oil-rich Azerbaijan was achieved with the assistance of a U.S.-organized covert program using Arab-Afghan operatives associated with bin Laden. Oil was the driving force of U.S. involvement in Central and South Asia, and oil led to U.S. coexistence with both Al-Qaeda and the world-dominating Afghan heroin trade. This brings us to another extraordinary distortion in the 9/11 report. While the drug trade was a source of income for the Taliban, it did not serve the same purpose for Al-Qaeda. Now, that drug trafficking does support Al-Qaeda-connected operations has been energetically asserted by the governments of Great Britain and many other European countries, as well as the head of the U.S. Congressional Task Force on Terrorism. Heroin trafficking has been a source of income, in particular, for Al-Qaeda-related warriors in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, Chechnya, and Kosovo. Most recently, it has supported terrorist attacks in the Netherlands and Spain. U.S. support for al-Qaeda elements, particularly in Azerbaijan and Kosovo, has increased dramatically the flow of drugs to the West and also to this country. In the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan, Arab Afghans clearly assisted the effort of U.S. oil companies to penetrate the region. In 1992, Richard Secord, Heini Eiderholt, and Ed Dearborn, three veterans of U.S. operations in Laos and then Iran-Contra, turned up in Baku under the cover of an oil company, Mega Oil. Now, Mega never did find oil, but it did contribute materially to the removal of Azerbaijan from the sphere of post-Soviet Russian influence. As Mega operatives in Azerbaijan, Secord, Adderholt, and Dearborn and their men engaged in military training. They passed brown bags filled with cash to members of the government, and above all, set up an airline on the model of Air America, which was soon picking up hundreds of Mujahideen mercenaries in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Mujahideen leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar in Afghanistan, who at the time was still allied with bin Laden, was, quote, observed recruiting Afghan mercenaries, that's say Arab Afghans, al-Qaeda, to fight in Azerbaijan against Armenia and its Russian allies, close quote. In this period, Hekmatyar's heroines surged through Baku into Chechnya and Russia and North America. It is difficult to believe that Dearborn's airline, much like Air America, was not involved. The triple pattern of drugs, oil, and al-Qaeda was seen again in Kosovo in 1998, where the al-Qaeda-backed Islamist jihadis of the Kosovo Liberation Army, KLA, received overt American assistance from the U.S. government. Though unmentioned in mainstream books on the war, both the al-Qaeda and the drug backgrounds of the KLA are recognized by experts and, to my knowledge, have never been contested by them. At the time, critics charged that U.S. oil interests were interested in building a trans-Balkan pipeline with U.S. Army protection. Although initially ridiculed, these critics were eventually proven correct. BBC News announced in December 2004 that a $1.2 billion pipeline south of a huge new U.S. Army base in Kosovo has been given a go-ahead by the governments of Albania, Bulgaria, and Macedonia. Meanwhile, by 2000, according to DEA statistics, Afghan heroin accounted for almost 20% of the heroin seized in the United States, nearly double the percentage taken 4 years earlier. Much of it is now distributed here by Kosovar Albanians. Now I'd like to talk a bit about Sergeant Ali Mohammed, and I'm only sorry I don't have enough time to do justice to this subject. The 9/11 report describes Ali Mohammed as, quote, a former Egyptian army officer who had moved to the United States in the mid-1980s, enlisted in the U.S. Army, and become an instructor at Fort Bragg, as well as helping to plan the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Kenya. In fact, Ali Mohammed was a very important al-Qaeda agent who, as the 9/11 Commission was told, quote, trained most of the al-Qaeda's top leadership, including persons who would later carry out the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, close quote. But the person telling the 9/11 Commission this, U.S. Attorney Patrick J. Fitzgerald, very much in the papers these days, misrepresented Ali Mohammed's FBI relationship. He told the commission that, quote, from 1994 until his arrest in 1998, Mohammed lived as an American citizen in California, applying for jobs as an FBI translator and working as a security guard for a defense contractor. Now, Ali Mohammed was not just an FBI job applicant. Unquestionably, he was an FBI informant, and almost certainly he was something more than this. A veteran of the CIA-trained bodyguards of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, he was able, despite being on a State Department watch list, to come to America around 1984 on what an FBI consultant has called, quote, a visa program controlled by the CIA, close quote, and to obtain a job, first as a security officer, then with U.S. Special Forces. In 1998, he took a lengthy leave of absence from the U.S. Army and went to fight in Afghanistan, totally against U.S. Army regulations. And there he met with Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was later bin Laden's chief deputy in al-Qaeda, and the rest of the Arab-Afghan leadership. Despite this breach of regulations, he was able to receive an honorable discharge 1 year later, at which point he established close contact with bin Laden in Afghanistan. Now, Ali Mohammed clearly enjoyed U.S. protection. In 1993, he was detained by the RCMP in Canada, and a single phone call to the United States secured his release. This enabled him to play a role in the same year in planning the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kenya in 1998. Now, eventually, he was allowed to plea bargain and receive a secret sentence. We don't know what the sentence is, still not known as late as 1991, where he's continuing to talk to the press. The amazing thing, although that he was named as a conspirator in that bombing, he was not an indicted conspirator, which itself is evidence of something going on behind the scene. Congress should determine the true relationship of the U.S. government to Ali Mohammed, who was close to bin Laden and above all Zawahiri, who has been called the main player in 9/11. This is very important, I think, that whereas the report focuses almost uniquely on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, many other sources independently say the main figure and the top brains in al-Qaeda was al-Zawahiri, who Ali Mohammed was clearly close to. I didn't put it in my remarks, but he brought Zawahiri twice to this country to raise funds, ostensibly for charities, but were funds that were used, in fact, for covert operations. So this was our U.S. insight into the top level of the Arab Afghans and of al-Qaeda. In particular, Congress should determine why Patrick Fitzgerald chose to mislead the American people about Mohammed's FBI status. In short, the al-Qaeda terror network accused of the 9/11 attacks was supported and expanded by U.S. programs and covert operations, both during and, most importantly, after the Soviet-Afghan War. So Congress should rethink their decision to grant still greater powers and budget to the agencies responsible for fostering this enemy in the first place. Sane voices clamor from the Muslim world that the best answer to terrorism is not war, but justice. We should listen to them. By using its energies to reduce the injustices tormenting Islam, the United States will do more to diminish terrorism than by creating any number of new directorates in Washington. Thank you.
This is absolutely riveting testimony. Absolutely riveting. Thank you.
That was Peter Dale Scott. Next, a question for the panelists from investigative journalist Wayne Manson.
Well, I really enjoyed this panel. I have 1,000 questions, but it's one. My question is, could you describe your feelings on what obviously is a nexus between past criminal conspirators involved in the Afghan war, BCCI, Iran-Contra, even going through Enron, which replaced BCCI as a Bush family cartel and slush fund. The nexus between these criminal conspirators, many of it's been described, they're in this administration, and the neoconservatives, many of them embrace that particular political ideology, and these Christian dominionists who also embrace much of the neoconservative ideology, who all believe in the end times and things like that, and that people who are willing to out and expose a covert CIA network designed to find the where weapons of mass destruction are being bought and sold. If people would do this, and they have a past criminal record, would these neoconservatives, these past criminal conspirators, in your opinion, have actively sought to suppress the intelligence prior to 9/11 to give them a reason to pass things like the Patriot Act, to do this projection of American power around the world through their manifesto, which was the Project for New American Century, because their ideological soulmates, who were the National Socialists in Germany, burned down their own parliament building to get the Enabling Act passed, which shredded the German Constitution. So my question is, how far do you think these neoconservatives, many of whom are past political conspirators, would go? Because we're talking about intelligence broke down. Nobody was held accountable. I think the only guy that lost his job on 9/11 was the head of security at Logan Airport. Everyone else got promoted or got presidential freedom medals and things like that. And John O'Neill, Mike mentioned, lost his job, also lost his life, but he was really after these Al-Qaeda networks in Yemen, and he was thrown out by the U.S. ambassador. So we have hundreds and hundreds of examples like that. So how far do you think they would have gone, and do you think it would be possible for the neoconservatives, with their philosophy, to have purposely allowed 9/11 to happen by ignoring intelligence, even maybe facilitating some of these terrorist cells that came to the United States?
Well, one can only speculate about this. I can't come up with neat facts or documents or anything that would prove it, and I like normally to stick to the level of documents. We heard this morning Mel Goodman in a speech, which generally I found very interesting. He said this wasn't an institutional failure, it was a personal failure. And then Mike Rupert came back and said this was A, deliberate, and B, systemic. And my own position is halfway in between. I do think that there was deliberate, whatever happened on 9/11, whether they let it happen, made it happen, whatever, it's an event which some people wished for. There's been too many. This, I think, was a cliche in the sort of high-tech, big-budget military thing that without another Pearl Harbor, we're not going to get the budgets we need. And I think at a minimum, there were some people who said, we have our Pearl Harbor, and proceeded to act accordingly. I don't see this as being the system, though. I think that this all goes back, in a sense, to the church reforms, which Mel Goodman praised this morning, because they created a situation where the CIA and, in general, the intelligence community was no longer the unsupervised arena that it had been before. It became, even if only minimally, under some kind of congressional review and minimal accountability. The result was we saw the beginning of offshoring and offloading of covert operations, the best example perhaps being Casey, CIA Director Casey's use of BCCI, and also the elaborate arrangements for supporting the Contras. Congress has said, don't do it. So instead of not doing it, you just go elsewhere to find the assets to do it. And this has created a kind of global symbiosis between the agents who are supposed to be defending the United States and the people on the other side whom we're supposed to be defending ourselves against. There is a great deal, I think, of interaction. Double agents, triple agents, people like Saeed Sheikh and Ali Mohammed. There is a milieu growing up that's in between the two. And it's a time for cabals. I think PNAC should be called a cabal, and not the only cabal. I don't put the Christian fundamentalists in this picture at all. I think they believe too sincerely what they're doing to be major players on this abstract international level. But when you have this kind of milieu and you have this kind of 20, 30 years now of experience with offloaded intelligence operations, you can say that it's not just because Bush was elected. This was something that was going to happen, something like this, because of that degree of interpenetration between the so-called defenders and the so-called enemy, both of which need to be looked at much more acutely by the public and Congress than they are at present.
Could I say a word in defense of the neoconservatives, not a position in which I usually find myself? I think it is a mistake to look for a kind of conspiracy gotcha moment here, and that for the following reason. First, because I'm completely convinced that the majority of neoconservatives, like as Mr. Scott said of the Christian fundamentalists, believe in what they're doing quite sincerely. What is dangerous in politics is not our vices, that is to say, nefarious activities in which people engage in mindfully, that sort of double agent, triple agent, spy versus spy, but rather our virtues, that the deeply held convictions of the neoconservatives, that it would be better for the few to lead the many, that it would be better for the Middle East to be reconfigured by the United States, that these very sincerely held beliefs are a problem, that it's not when they depart from their beliefs, but when they fulfill them, that the nation is maybe most endangered. And that looking at tiny events for that gotcha moment directs our gaze away from these broad movements in American politics, repeated in American foreign policy over not only over the course of years, but over the course of decades. The expansion of executive power at home, on the domestic front, that all these things are so profound, so persistent, and so dangerous that any event pales in comparison to those, and that we need to keep our eye on these, on the broad directions of American foreign policy and the broad directions of American domestic political change in order to appreciate what the true effects of this change has been.
That was political scientist Ann Norton of the University of Pennsylvania. Before that, Peter Dale Scott, author of various books on U.S. covert wars, foreign policy, and their connection to the drug trade, with questions from journalist Wayne Madsen. They were participants in a day-long briefing held by Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, July 23rd, titled "The 9/11 Commission Report 1 Year Later, A Citizen's Critique, Did the Commission Get It Right?" We'll have more material from this historic briefing on future programs. I'd like to close with an article that relates to Professor Norton's final comments regarding the carnage committed in the name of someone's good intentions. The title of this article is "How Hitler Became a Dictator." It's written by Jacob G. Hornberger. Whenever U.S. officials wish to demonize someone, they inevitably compare him to Adolf Hitler. The message immediately resonates with people, because everyone knows that Hitler was a brutal dictator. But how many people know how Hitler actually became a dictator? My bet is very few. I would also bet that more than a few people would be surprised at how he pulled it off, especially given that after World War I, Germany had become a democratic republic. The story of how Hitler became a dictator is set forth in The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer, on which this article is based. In the presidential election held on March 13, 1932, there were four candidates: the incumbent, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, Adolf Hitler, and two minor candidates, Ernst Thälmann and Theodor Düsterberg. The results were: Hindenburg won 49.6% of the votes, Hitler 30.1%, Thälmann 13.2%, and Düsterberg 6.8%. At the risk of belaboring the obvious, almost 70% of the German people voted against Hitler, causing his supporter Joseph Goebbels, who would later become Hitler's Minister of Propaganda, to lament in his journal, "We are beaten, terrible outlook, party circles badly depressed and dejected." Since Hindenburg had not received a majority of the vote, however, a runoff election had to be held among the top three vote-getters. On April 19, 1932, the runoff results were Hindenburg, 53%, Hitler, 36.8%, and Thälmann, 10.2%. Thus, even though Hitler's vote total had risen, he still had been decisively rejected by the German people. On June 1, 1932, Hindenburg appointed Franz von Papen as Chancellor of Germany, whom Scheurer described as an unexpected and ludicrous figure. Papen immediately dissolved the Reichstag, the National Congress, and called for new elections, the third legislative election in 5 months. Hitler and his fellow members of the National Socialist, a.k.a. Nazi Party, who were determined to bring down the Republic and establish dictatorial rule in Germany, did everything they could to create chaos in the streets, including initiating political violence and murder. The situation got so bad that martial law was proclaimed in Berlin. Even though Hitler had badly lost the presidential election, he was drawing ever larger crowds during the congressional election. As Scheurer points out, in one day, July 27th, he spoke to 60,000 persons in Brandenburg, to nearly as many in Potsdam, and that evening to 120,000 massed in the giant Grunewald Stadium in Berlin, while outside an additional 100,000 heard his voice by loudspeaker. The July 31, 1932 election produced a major victory for Hitler's National Socialist Party. The party won 230 seats in the Reichstag, making it Germany's largest political party, but it still fell short of a majority in the 608-member body. On the basis of that victory, Hitler demanded that President Hindenburg appoint him chancellor and place him in complete control of the state. Otto von Meissner, who worked for Hindenburg, later testified at Nuremberg that Hindenburg replied that because of the tense situation, he could not in good conscience risk transferring the power of government to a new party such as the National Socialists, which did not command a majority and which was intolerant, noisy, and undisciplined. Political deadlocks in the Reichstag soon brought a new election, this one on November 6, 1932. In that election, the Nazis lost 2 million votes and 34 seats. Thus, even though the National Socialist Party was still the largest political party, it had clearly lost ground among the voters. Attempting to remedy the chaos and the deadlocks, Hindenburg fired Papen and appointed an army general named Kurt von Schleyer as the new German chancellor. Unable to secure a majority coalition in the Reichstag, however, Schleyer finally tendered his resignation to Hindenburg 57 days after he'd been appointed. On January 30, 1933, President Hindenburg appointed Adolf Hitler Chancellor of Germany. Although the National Socialists never captured more than 37% of the national vote, and even though they still held a minority of cabinet posts and fewer than 50% of the seats in the Reichstag, Hitler and the Nazis set out to consolidate their power. With Hitler as chancellor, that proved to be a fairly easy task. On February 27, 1933, Hitler was enjoying supper at the Goebbels home when the telephone rang with an emergency message. The Reichstag is on fire. Hitler and Goebbels rushed to the fire, where they encountered Hermann Göring, who would later become Hitler's air minister. Göring was shouting at the top of his lungs, "This is the beginning of the communist revolution. We must not wait a minute. We will show no mercy. Every communist official must be shot where he is found. Every communist deputy must this very day be strung up." The day after the fire, the Prussian government announced that it had found communist publications stating government buildings, museums, mansions, and essential plants were to be burned down. Women and children were to be sent in front of terrorist groups. The burning of the Reichstag, engineered by the Nazis and Adolf Hitler, was the signal for a bloody insurrection and civil war. Terrorist acts against individuals, against private property, and against the life and limb of the peaceful population. But how did Göring know, and why was he so certain, that the Reichstag fire had been set by the Communist Party members? Arrested on the spot was a Dutch communist named Marinus van der Lubbe. Most historians now believe that van der Lubbe was actually duped by the Nazis into setting the fire, and probably was even assisted by them without him realizing it. Why would Hitler and his associates turn a blind eye to an impending terrorist attack on the German National Congressional Building, or actually assist with such a horrific deed? Because the Nazis and Adolf Hitler knew what government officials have known all throughout history, that during extreme national crisis and emergencies, people are most scared and thus much more willing to surrender their liberties and treasure in return for security. And that is exactly what happened during the Reichstag so-called terrorist crisis. The day after the fire, Hitler persuaded President Hindenburg to issue a decree entitled, quote, "For the Protection of the People and the State," that was justified as a defensive measure against communist acts of violence endangering the state. The decree suspended the constitutional guarantees pertaining to all civil liberties. Restrictions on personal liberty, on the right of free expression of opinion, including freedom of the press, on the rights of assembly and association, and violations of the privacy of postal, telegraphic, and telephonic communications, and warrants for house searches, orders for confiscations as well as restrictions on property, are also permissible beyond the legal limits otherwise prescribed, said this law. 2 weeks after the Reichstag fire, Hitler requested the Reichstag temporarily delegate its power to him so he could adequately deal with the crisis. Denouncing opponents to his request, Hitler shouted, quote, "Germany will be free, but not through you," close quote. When the vote was taken, the result was 441 for, 84 against, giving Hitler the two-thirds majority he needed to suspend the German Constitution. On March 23, 1933, what has gone down in German history as the Enabling Act made Hitler dictator of Germany, freed of all legislative and constitutional constraints. One of the most dramatic consequences was in the judicial arena. Scheurer points out, under the Weimar Constitution, judges were independent, subject only to the law, protected from arbitrary removal, and bound, at least in theory, by Article 109 to safeguard equality before the law. In fact, in the Reichstag terrorist case, while the court convicted van der Lubbe of the crime, he was executed, three other defendants, all communists, were acquitted, which infuriated Hitler and Göring. Within a month, the Nazis had transferred jurisdiction over treason cases from the Supreme Court to a new People's Court, which, as Scheurer points out, soon became the most dreaded tribunal in the land. It consisted of two professional judges and five others chosen from among party officials, the SS and the armed forces, thus giving the latter a majority vote. There was no appeal from its decisions and sentences. Occasionally, however, for propaganda purposes, when relatively light sentences were to be given, foreign correspondents were invited to attend. One of the Reichstag terrorist defendants, who had angered Göring during the trial with a severe cross-examination of Göring, did not benefit from this acquittal. Scheurer explains, the German communist leader was immediately taken into protective custody, where he remained until his death during the Second World War. In addition to the People's Court, which handled treason cases, the Nazis also set up the Special Court, which handled cases of political crimes or, quote, insidious attacks against the government, close quote. These courts consisted of three judges who customarily had to be trusted Nazi Party members without a jury. A Nazi prosecutor had the choice of bringing action in such cases before either an ordinary court or the special court, and invariably he chose the latter for obvious reasons. Defense lawyers before this court, as before the Volksgerichtshof, had to be approved by Nazi officials. Sometimes, even if they were approved, they fared badly. Thus, the lawyers who attempted to represent the widow of the murdered Catholic action leader Dr. Klausner in her suit for damages against the state were whisked off to Sachsenhausen concentration camp, where they were kept until they formally withdrew the action. Even lenient treatment by the special court was no guarantee for the defendant, however, as Pastor Martin Niemöller discovered when he was acquitted of major political charges and sentenced to time served for minor charges. Leaving the courtroom, Niemöller was taken into custody by the Gestapo and taken to a concentration camp. The Nazis also implemented a legal concept called Schutzhaft, or protective custody, which enabled them to arrest and incarcerate people without charging them with a crime. Scheurer explains, "Protective custody did not protect a man from possible harm, as it did in more civilized countries. It punished him by putting him behind barbed wire. On August 2, 1934, Hindenburg died, and the title of president was abolished. Hitler's title became Führer and Reich Chancellor. Not surprisingly, he used the initial 4-year temporary grant of emergency powers that had been given to him by the Enabling Acts to consolidate his omnipotent control over the entire country. Oddly enough, even though his dictatorship very quickly became complete, Hitler returned to the Reichstag every 4 years to renew the temporary delegation of emergency powers that it had given him to deal with the Reichstag arson crisis. Needless to say, the Reichstag rubber-stamped each of his requests. For their part, the German people quickly accepted the new order of things. Keep in mind that the average non-Jewish German was pretty much unaffected by the new laws and decrees. As long as a German citizen kept his head down, worked hard, took care of his family, sent his children to the public schools and the Hitler Youth Organization, and most important, didn't involve himself in political dissent against the government, a visit by the Gestapo was very unlikely. Keep in mind also that while the Nazis established concentration camps in the 1930s, the number of inmates ranged in the thousands. It wouldn't be until the 1940s that the death camps and the gas chambers that killed millions would be implemented. Describing how the average German adapted to the new order, Scheurer writes, "The overwhelming majority of Germans did not seem to mind that their personal freedom had been taken away, that so much of the culture had been destroyed and replaced with a mindless barbarism, nor that their life and work had become regimented to a degree never before experienced by a people accustomed for generations to a great deal of regimentation. The Nazi terror in the early years affected the lives of relatively few Germans, and a newly arrived observer was somewhat surprised to see that the people of this country did not seem to feel they were being cowed. On the contrary, they supported it with genuine enthusiasm. Somehow, it imbued them with a new hope and a new confidence and an astonishing faith in the future of their country." And that was an article, "How Hitler Became a Dictator," by Jacob G. Hornberger. Hornberger is the founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, a libertarian-oriented think tank. That wraps it up for the show this week. If you'd like to pass this program to others, you can download an MP3 copy from our show archive, which also contains all our other previous shows, at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you.
Like an unwelcome